Welcome to Optimistic Voices, a podcast of helping children worldwide. We help children worldwide by strengthening and empowering families and communities. This podcast is for people interested in deep conversations with thought leaders in the fields of child welfare, global health, and international missions.
I'm Melody Curtis, Executive Director of Helping Children Worldwide, and normally I'm back there in the sound booth doing some sound engineering on the podcast, but for this episode, Dr. Laura Horvath let me come out and join her along with Reverend Wayne Lavender. The three of us are going to discuss something that is near and dear to our heart.
As you know, I'm Laura Horvath, one of the hosts of Optimistic Voices podcast, and we're excited to share this episode with you today. We'll be talking about what it means to shift the model of care for children that you support for decades to something completely different. Since the ratification of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child more than 30 years ago, there's been a global movement to promote models of care for children and orphans, shifting from residential models like orphanages into models that include things like biological families, kinship, which is where children live with their extended families, foster and adoptive families, even families that are led by older children. Scripture, life and experience, years of academic research, all agree that children grow up best in families. Yet too often, the response to orphans and other children in crisis is to build yet another orphanage. Children need love, a sense of belonging, and the experience of family and connection in order to thrive. Our friends at Strengthening Families and Children, Mick Peace and Dan Hope, do this exercise with participants that they when they're out on training activities, and they'll ask people in the room to list all the things a child needs in order to thrive. And they'll list things like having enough to eat, access to education or medical care, having a relationship with God. And these are all really important things, and they are all priorities in a child's life. And then Mick or Dan will say, prioritize those in the order of the most important to the least. And what Mick has told me is that it almost doesn't matter the order that most of those things fall in. People will put them in different orders, in different cultures, in different contexts, and it almost doesn't matter except for the top two, which should always be the same. The first is safety, and the second is a sense of belonging. And here's the thing. If you care about orphans and vulnerable children, you are, of course, concerned for their safety. And orphanages are fantastic at keeping kids safe. Well, go to orphanages anyway. What orphanages, even the best, cannot do is give a child a true sense of belonging in the sense that a family can. And what Mick has said over and over, I've heard him say this, is that a child wants to belong to someone, not something, a family, not an orphanage. So given all of that, we've asked Reverend Wayne Lavender to be our guest on this episode of Optimistic Voices. Reverend Lavender, PhD, is a United Methodist pastor currently serving as the executive director of Foundation for Orphans and faculty member in the political science department at Quinnipiac. Did I say that right?
Quinnipiac.
Quinnipiac. I should have asked you before I said it. Quinnipiac University. He earned his PhD from George Mason School of Public Policy. He has an MA and a Master's of Divinity from the Pacific School of Religion and a BA from Duke University. He was the winner of the Harry Denham Evangelism Award in 2004 for his ministry at New Milford UMC in New Milford, Connecticut. He's worked and taught at universities in Iraq and Mozambique. He's the author of 7 books, his latest being Pure Religion, which was released in 2020. And he lives with his wife, Maureen, in the Conference and Retreat Center for the Foundation for Orphans in Hamden, Connecticut. Foundation for Orphans is an IRS-approved 501c3, like Helping Children Worldwide is, a nonprofit whose mission is to end the orphan pandemic. And Wayne, we're going to ask you a little bit later what you mean by that phrase. Their work is concentrated now in Mozambique and Iraq, but it's expanding to Syria, Tanzania, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Wayne's got 20-plus years of experience working to support orphan care and as the executive director of Foundation for Orphans. For 24 years, FBO has raised money to build and support orphanages in Mozambique, And when HCW met Wayne and the Foundation for Orphans team earlier this year, they were raising money to build additional orphanages in Mozambique and DRC. But then all of that kind of suddenly changed. So, Wayne, we're excited to have you on the podcast today. And we would love for you to share a little bit about you, your work, the work of the Foundation for Orphans, and why you were thinking about changing this model that you've supported for so long.
And I'm going to do the thing that I always do to Laura, which is why they rarely let me come out of the sound engineering room. And that is throw a little bit into the works, because we always like to say that good orphanages keep children safe. But that's a question that I'd like us to explore more in depth during this conversation as well, as to what it is we mean by keeping children safe. Mm.
Yeah, so, that's a great question.
Yeah.
Let's start, though, with some background on, Wayne, on your work. I think it's fair to say, because we've had some conversations with you, that this has been like literally a life calling, this work that you do in support of orphans. And so could you talk a little bit about what that's meant to you, how you came to be called to this work, and how that's sort of evolved for you over the years?
Sure. So thank you, Dr. Horvath. Laura.
Thank you.
It's good to be here. And it's good to be with all you listening and watching. So Laura gave a long introduction to me. So, you know, I felt like I could listen to her all day. And that was good.
That was
made
good
me feel
advice.
Happy. And I think those are things I sent you, by the way.
Yeah.
And I think it was all true. But I was ordained in 1984, served churches in Connecticut. I was at a good-sized church in New Milford, Connecticut. I was there for 12 years. We grew from about 85 a week to 350 a week. That's where I won the Demon wow. Evangelism Award. I thought I'd retire out of that church. Mm-hmm. I was asked twice to be a district superintendent. The last thing I wanted to be was a district superintendent, because my administrative skills are basically finding someone who could do administrative tasks for me. But my life changed in 1998. That was my first trip to Mozambique. My conference sent VIM teams. I had no interest in doing that. I read an article in our newspaper, or conference newspaper, one day inviting people to attend. I quickly turned the page. The next day I was running, I was jogging, and heard a voice say, go to Mozambique. Mm-hmm. So then it intimidated me. I called my mentor. I told him, I said, what should I do? He said, I think you should go to Mozambique. Doggone it.
That's not always. You know it's a God call right. when your response is, what?
Wait, you called the wrong person.
I called the wrong person. Son of a gun. So I went to Mozambique, and I was, how old was I? I was 40s. And I had studied global poverty, extreme poverty, seen on the news, read about it. But to go and see it in person changed my life. I just can't describe. In 1998, Mozambique was considered the poorest nation on the planet because it had just come through its Revolutionary War, its Civil War. It had flooding, it had droughts, like us in many ways.
Yeah.
And people were selling rocks on the streets. They had big rocks, little rocks, gravel, and sand. Hmm. I don't know what they were doing, hundreds of them. There was as many as 80,000 street children in Maputo. Yeah. So it changed my life. So that was, our church was in the midst of building a $1 million addition. I had my own kids. Our church was growing. We sent four people the next year. In 1999, it changed their lives. In 2002, I led a group of six from our church. We went to the orphanage I had been to before. Talk about safe. This orphanage was up the hill from a swamp. The swamp had mosquitoes. The mosquitoes had malaria. The kids were getting malaria. There was a child dying about every month. Out of only 30 or 40 there. It had been a leper's colony. The church had converted it to an orphanage in the early 1990s when they started getting children because of the wars. And, the AIDS was killing the adults.
Right.
So we met with the director. We went there four times in about 10 days, maybe five times. And my team was just completely committed to helping these children. And we asked the director if we can raise funds and build a new orphanage in a different location, would that be good for you? And she broke down crying. She said, that's been our prayer for years. Mm. And so then we spoke to the district superintendent. We spoke to the bishop's wife. We made all these arrangements. They all said, yes, 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 yes. We went back to my church in New Milford. We raised $85,000. We built a new orphanage about 30 miles away. The kids moved there. And that really kind of started the Foundation for Orphans, even though I didn't launch it till a few years later. Right. So we were committed to orphanages, and we've been committed to orphanages mm-hmm. because that's kind of what we knew.
Yeah.
The people there asked us to build a new orphanage. We discovered an orphanage. The kids were not safe. They didn't have access to school, water, food. You know, it's just a disaster. So once we get them the new home, they had access to electricity, not all time, but 4 hours a day.
I can relate to that.
They had clean water, more or less. They had access to school. They had moved from this leper's colony, which was isolated in the bush, where we took the kids to town once, and they wouldn't get out of the car because they were afraid of other people.
Right.
So they began interacting with kids at school. They actually started a soccer team. They're actually quite good. They have a varsity JV team. So they were part of a community again.
Right.
And so that sort of launched the Foundation for Orphans. And we continued to build orphanages because, one, the bishop and the church leaders over there said, we want more orphanages.
Right.
Two, we knew how to do it. And three, it was a model that seemed to work for better or worse.
Yeah.
But I knew on a deeper level that intellectually and somehow I knew explicitly inside me that orphanages weren't the right model.
Right.
And when the United Nations decreed a few years ago that no more orphanage should be built, I read that, I understood it, but we kept doing it anyway because that's what we knew how to do.
Right.
And we also thought that our orphanages are better than most orphanages. And I think they are.
Yeah.
Having said that, I still knew somehow it wasn't the right thing. But I do think, you know, our goal was to provide children with educational, emotional, physical, and spiritual support.
Right.
And we would do those things. And we would try to limit them to 50. But sometimes we got like 80 kids mm-hmm. in one of our orphanages just because...
Because the need is so great.
If you build it, they'll come.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, what you're speaking to is how you get caught between, you know this is not the right model. You're not sure what the model should be, but you've got, you know, tens of thousands of kids that are living separated from family care, that are in desperate situations. And so you select the solution that you know, right?
That's right.
And like you said, if you build it, they will come.
Right.
Because if you offer a solution that's better than what they're seeing happen, that's the answer everyone's going to gravitate toward. So
no, I said many times that I was not a fan of orphanages.
Yeah,
I said that in churches speaking. I said, our goal is to keep parents alive.
Right,
shouldn't
right.
we be doing that?
Right.
And if parents die, shouldn't the kids go to a relative,
right.
uncle or aunt? And if that doesn't work, shouldn't there be some sort of foster care system?
Yeah.
And orphanages is the final response. It's the final answer. But what we found in Mozambique was there was no other options, we thought, other than orphanages. And that's what I would tell people.
Yeah.
The family has died. We didn't keep them alive. Their aunts and uncles have also died, mm-hmm. or they're too poor to take in a kid. There's no foster care system in Mozambique, so they end up in an orphanage.
Yeah.
So I thought it was the final resort. We did it. We continue to do it. I knew, as I keep saying, intellectually, and I knew kind of intuitively it wasn't the right answer. I also knew from a scale perspective it wasn't the right answer. Mozambique has as many as 1 million orphans.
Right.
Now, again, orphans, that's single orphan, double orphan, or their parents may be living but unable to take care of
them. What we call poverty orphans.
Right. Poverty orphans.
Right. So, right. Wayne, you just used a term that I don't think everyone in the audience will understand. You used the term single orphan, double orphan. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so I, like everybody else, I think, used to think an orphan was someone whose both parents had died. So the United Nations again decreed, I think 15 years ago mm-hmm. or more, that a child of whom one or both parents have died is an orphan. So a single orphan is if a mother or father has died and the other one's still alive. Double is both parents have
right.
died. So 1 million single or double orphans in Mozambique is a number we've been using.
Yeah.
Or like you said, poverty orphans, because we have discovered that as many as 80% of them might have one parent alive.
Right.
But 1 million kids, for us to build our orphanages, now we call them homes for children already because the word orphanage has a kind of negative connotation.
It's beginning to, yeah.
And I think even from Dickens' day, you know?
Yeah, fair.
So we call them homes for children, but then we also say / orphanage because people know what orphanage
That's
is.
Right.
They may not know what a home for children is. So we already knew that it had a negative connotation. So where was I going with that? We've been building these, but we knew intuitively and intellectually that we couldn't scale them. So we can build a home for children for 50 children at about $125,000. Well, I don't know how much houses cost here in Northern Virginia, a lot more than that.
Right.
So we'd say that's a pretty good deal for 50 kids, $125,000. But then it costs us about $800 a year to keep these kids there.
Right.
That's for food and for the moms and school supplies and all that.
So, and you can't take any more in. Like they once they move in, you've got them for
What's the math on that? If we're talking about a million,
well, exactly.
And you can take in
50.
50.
Yeah.
What is the
how do you make a dent?
Yeah, it's like the federal debt in the U.S. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's in the billions.
Right.
So we've actually done some research. How many, you know, how many orphanages do we need to build to take care of a million kids? Right. And the operating cost, I just so we knew we couldn't scale.
Yeah.
We couldn't scale our model.
Yeah.
Now we were doing more and more, and the bishop's very strategic. She's putting them all throughout Mozambique. Right. Mozambique's a pretty big nation. Mm-hmm. It's like the size of California. So when I go now, I've got to start at the bottom, visit this one, this one, this one, this one.
Right.
So it's a pain for me, which is small, considering they've got kids kind of near where they were located. But when we met you, it all came together. You know, I teach my students. I say, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And that's an old quote from, I think, Confucius.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's so true, because if my students aren't ready, they skip class, they sleep in class, they're on their phones. I mean, I'm not stupid. I can see them buying stuff on Amazon during class. Right? That's what they do. I don't know what else they do, but I can see them on their computer, you know? I can see the ones taking notes because they stop and look up, and I can see the ones not taking.
Right.
Anyway, when a student's ready,
if they're listening, that might surprise them.
He knows.
I know. So when the student's ready, though, the teacher will appear, and I was ready. So when you guys came to that event and you were saying there's a better model, I barely knew of the different models. I didn't think foster care would work in Mozambique. Because it concerns about in the U.S. But it's not just foster care. You know, it's different opportunities. And I knew our model couldn't scale. So I was ready.
Okay.
So I jumped at it that day. And I'd say half of our board jumped at it that day.
So now, that was shocking.
The other half are a little reluctant, I have to say. We still got...
That's to be expected.
Of course.
Just for our audience, just to kind of give them the backstory on this, because we're having like a little, we have a little...
Inside story
going on here. We got an invitation. Actually, Melody, it wasn't even an invitation to us. It was an invitation to one of our board members to attend a fundraiser at a small Methodist church in Virginia Beach. And he forwarded it to us, and he said, "Hey, I can't go. Laura, I know you've got a place down there. What do you want to do about this?" And I said to Melody, "Should we go?" And Melody said, "Absolutely, we should go." So I promise you, we were going to show up and sit in the back.
You said that.
We were going to sit in the back and behave ourselves. And those of you in the audience who know us probably don't believe that, but we really were.
I don't even believe it.
Right.
We were just going to be... Little flies on the wall.
And then at the end, we were going to give Wayne our business card and say, "Hi, we like orphans too. Maybe we could meet and talk, you know, about our different programs." And so that was the plan. And we arrived a little early and met your wonderful team and the mission team at Thalia United Methodist Church. And I think right out of the gate, you said, "Who are you and what do you do?" We shared that.
So much for your plan.
Right out the window.
And Tom Vankus, I think, was there said, "Well, who do you know?" He wasn't sure we were real. What were we doing there? Who do you know?
Who do you know?
So it's like we had to prove our credentials before you guys let
Tom
us in.
Tom does that
room.
To everybody.
Unfortunately, our credentials held water.
Yeah. You knew the same people.
And he actually reached out and contacted them. So before... much longer in the day, maybe 30 minutes later, he would verify that we were real. We were legitimate.
We were who we said we were. And we sat through your great presentation and the statistics that you shared, and I knew we were on the same page. And then you asked us, "Hey, can we have a conversation around, you know, what it is you do and all that?" And I will say that you knocked the pins out from under me. with how quickly you and your team and the pastor at Thalia
just pivoted.
Well, I think it's like I said, I knew intellectually and I knew intuitively that our model was not the right model.
Right.
We kept doing it, even though I knew, but I didn't know anything better. And what was interesting that day, so I was ordained, I said, in 84, so I have a long experience in churches. And I've long since come to the realization that whoever shows up for an event is who shows up for a reason.
Yeah.
So the Thalia and I met this church, and the church leaders down there tried to promote it. And we were hoping to have 10 to 15 clergy from Virginia Beach, Norfolk area, and sort of turn them on to caring for orphans and vulnerable children. And nobody showed up but you two. And I don't take that as an insult anymore.
Yeah.
You know, like I've done so many services where less people showed up than expected, or other times more show up.
Right.
It is what it is. So I think that was a God moment that you two came, because then we didn't have to focus on newbies.
Right.
We were able to dig deeper into your model and our model and how they could sync with each other.
Right.
So it was really the right people came
that
day.
I did feel that way.
And you guys were able to pivot also from sitting in the back to, after my presentation, taking the floor to share what you did.
Yeah.
And I'm thankful there's a member of the church in Thalia United Methodist Church, Richard Norman, who has led their whole project to coordinate the church around one mission project. They're like many United Methodist churches. They've got about 40 missions. So they do the bread, they do feeding people, and they do clothing people, and summer camps for kids and local kids. And they do a little this, a little that. They do scholarships, you know. They haven't ever had a central unified mission project. So for 4 years, Richard tried to get a central mission around caring for orphans.
Right.
And he's been very clear that they're not raising $125,000 to build a home for children. They're raising funds to care for 50 children.
Right.
So they actually have a chart, you know, one of those thermometers, but it's a child, and they have one child, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50.
Right.
So it's not a dollar amount, and it's not...
It's how many kids.
Yeah. So I'm meeting with them Thursday, but I've spoken with them through Zoom. I've spoken with their pastor, Joe Barner, with Richard and others. They seem more than willing to not use those funds to build an orphanage,
right,
but to use them in a more effective way to reach more kids.
Wow.
So Thursday will confirm that decision.
Yeah.
So I was ready to jump. Joe was ready to jump. Others were ready to jump, but I think we're ready to go.
Yeah. Well, that's just extraordinary to me because, you know, here we go. And we're big believers in what we call radical collaboration. So we're big believers in just connecting with people who are engaged in any way and work with orphans and vulnerable children to share ideas, to share best practices, you know, find out what you do with your program. And do you do something we could learn from? Do we do something you might be able to learn from? And so, it, you know, we're terrifying everyone in the audience about the fact that we're going to gate crash your fundraiser and blow a hole in it. But the fact that that the people at Thalia were already thinking in terms of not a building, which I think is extraordinary because
it is.
Donors love to fundraise for something they could point to and say, I paid for a brick of that, more than the sort of softer, harder, less tangible idea of supporting a child and all that that means.
That's absolutely
so the fact that the ground was already kind of laid and that we showed up at that moment in that specific space, I think is really
amazing. Small distinction. Is we weren't, I had been in that church. I spoke in the Sunday before. That was kind of our fundraising in that church.
Yeah.
This event was to be an information sharing.
Right? Okay.
So we were trying to get other United Methodist churches in that general region to come and learn about Foundation for Orphans. So maybe that helped too. It wasn't really a fundraising event.
Good. But I feel less guilty then.
Exactly. I wanted to relieve your guilt.
Thank you.
I wanted you to feel better.
Thank you. So, you're kind of speaking, you're talking around something that you've shared with us before, which is this, I think you shared a statistic with us about the percentage of Methodists specifically, because our Helping Children Worldwide was born out of the Methodist tradition, and your front foundation is as well. So that's sort of where we connect up. But you've talked about specifically Methodist support or engagement in orphan missions and how low that actually is in the denomination. Do you want to speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so 30 times the Bible tells us to care for orphans.
Right.
It's more than any other group who we're told to care for. We're told to feed the hungry and, you know, all those things. But 30 times we're told to care for. That's often linked with caring for widows and strangers.
Right.
Not always. Sometimes orphan alone. Orphans and widows are because the man in biblical times was usually the bread owner or breadwinner. So if the man died, he would leave a widow and orphans. The Bible says care for widows and orphans 30 times. John Wesley said caring for orphans is the highest form of charity on the earth.
Right.
So if you're a United Methodist, and again, most of our base is, and most of yours started that way, then it should be in your DNA. It's in the Bible. Mm-hmm. It's in Wesley. So we've done some research, and it's hard to come up with numbers. So we've worked with GBGM. We've worked with VIM. The VIM team's volunteer in mission. They're tracking numbers because we also know a lot of churches that work with orphans don't do it through GBGM or don't do it through VIM. But the number we've come up with is 1% to 3% of United Methodist churches are involved caring for orphans in some way or other. That's sending one person on the VIM team, sending money to GBGM, doing something on their own outside of the institution. So what that means to me is we've got this huge upside.
Right.
97% of the church
that we've not tapped yet, or more,
that are just not doing anything. And so I always look for my sweet spot where I may need to call up 10 churches to get one to invite me to speak. Because there's churches that do no mission work.
Yeah.
They do no mission work because they don't want to do mission work.
Right.
For whatever reason, they feel like we're not, or their mission is evangelism, which is fine. People see mission as a different way. Then there's other churches that are doing great mission work right now. Maybe they are working with, I don't know, stamping out diseases in the developing world. Maybe they're feeding people in their own community or prison. They're already doing something. They don't have the capacity to do more.
Yeah.
So what I need to do is find the churches that want to do mission that are not doing mission.
Right.
But with 97% of our churches in this time of schism and frustration and decline, you know, I also don't ever speak without talking about how the United Methodist Church was established in 1968. That's when other denominations came together. Our tradition goes back to Wesley, you know, way before that. But since 1968, when we were formed, we've declined every single year. That's 54 years. We've declined membership, Sunday school, confirmation. No matter how you look at it, 54-year losing streak. So imagine, you know, we're in Northern Virginia, Washington's not far away.
Right.
Imagine if the Washington football team had a 54-year losing streak.
Right. That's not hard to imagine.
Maybe they do. Oh, I know they don't.
It's not quite that long. But
or the Washington, what's the baseball team? Used to be the Senators, now it's the
Nationals.
The Nationals.
Yeah.
So what if they lost for 54 straight years? You'd fire the manager. You'd fire the players.
Right.
We've had 54 straight years of loss. Then we had COVID, which has been devastating. We're about to split. We're already splitting. I can't even tell.
Right.
And what are we going to do? So I keep saying, let's gather around a biblical and Wesleyan principle.
Right.
Caring for orphans and vulnerable children. I guarantee that within a mile of this church, some child's going to go to bed hungry tonight. Doesn't have to be international. It can be caring for kids locally. Let's focus on kids in the future. But overseas, we can make a huge impact. So we also work with the Children's Center of Hamden, Hamden, Connecticut, where I live. They were an orphanage in the 1830s. They've merged. Now they're a residential treatment center. They have 400 kids, 200 residents, 200 in and out. Their budget is $5 million.
Yeah.
For $5 million, we could take care of
thousands. I can't even imagine what
tens
we could
thousands.
Do with $5 million.
Well, and what we know.
In Africa or any of these.
So is there anything wrong with taking care of 400 kids in Connecticut? No. But we can do so much more. And if God, if every child is equal in God's eye, which I believe, you know, American kids, we're all kind of narcissistic and think about our own first, right?
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that. But if God cares for every child equally and we can care for 10 times or 20 times more, we can scale up.
Right.
I want to back you up to a term of art that you're using that we don't even recognize as a term of art. That is mission.
Mm-hmm.
You keep saying churches are not engaged in mission. And I'm sure that every church is going to argue with that point because that's their purpose is mission in terms of what their work is with their congregation. Mm-hmm. So how are you defining the term mission that 97% of United Methodist churches aren't engaging in mission? What does that mean?
Well, yeah,
to you?
So when I say broad brush churches aren't engaged with mission, I think people would disagree with you. There are churches that do no mission. Their mission is to worship Sunday morning and have a pancake breakfast or spaghetti dinner, mm-hmm. and that's it the whole year. I did some research on my book, Pure Religion, and the subcategory is the orphan opportunity.
Right.
So I think this is an opportunity for the churches because it gives people something to focus on. It gives them a uniting purpose. The United Methodist Church right now doesn't have a core that we stand for.
Right.
We just don't. You know, we fight over sexual identity.
Right.
And we fought over that since 1972. So 50 years we fought, but we don't have a core identity. So I think our mission and evangelism go together. If we would be the denomination of embrace orphans and vulnerable children, then when people go home, they can tell people at work and their neighbors and their church can say, we care for orphans. People know the church shouldn't be fighting over sexual identity. Right. They know we shouldn't be fighting over politics. We shouldn't be fighting over wealth. You know, pastors shouldn't be living in $10 million homes. We shouldn't be supporting war. We should be doing what Jesus said.
Right.
So if we can unite around that, we can move forward. Now, in my research, I found that approximately 3% of all money churches raise, United Methodist Church, goes towards mission. Mm-hmm. So there is money being spent, 3%.
Right.
So that's a small number, I think.
Yeah.
You know, if the Foundation for Orphans, if we use 97% for administrative costs, what if you guys use 97% for administrative costs?
There goes our Charity Navigator rating.
You'd be shut down.
Yeah, the IRS would come, knock on our door,
exactly.
We'd be over.
That's the church average across our country.
Wow.
So I wrote that, and I had a friend reading my book recently in North Haven, the next town over, and she drives over to our house, like, you know, Saturday afternoon, like, she said, I can't believe, she said, that's exactly the number of our churches. She said, 3%? How'd you know that? She said, you wrote this book about my church. I said, no, that's the average.
Right.
So at least our church is not under the average.
Yeah.
Could be worse.
So
did I answer your question?
Yeah, but I think it's just, we say mission. And we use that word mission to talk about outward ministry to
service
people who are beyond ourselves. So,
right.
So if we're talking about ministry to ourselves and our own community within the community of the church, we exclude that from mission. But that is the definition of those churches that don't do any outward reach beyond their own
right.
community.
Right.
And so we're talking about mission. We're talking about the 3% of congregations who have decided that it is their work, that it is their calling to reach outside of themselves and to be the hands and feet of Christ. So I want to step back and talk a little bit about your award for evangelism. How did you move your congregation from 80 to what was that number?
Well, we averaged about 350 when I left in 2005. So New Milford at the time, so I was a younger pastor. I had hair and my hair was reddish.
You have some hair.
And your eyebrows are red. So.
Exactly. Thank you. Thank you for noticing. So I'm a high energy person. The church that in New Milford where I went had declined from about 140 down to 85. Mm-hmm. And most of our churches were declining. And we just decided to open our church up. So long story short, the previous pastor had health issues, was living in another town, didn't come to church. The secretary had a dog. She kept the door locked. The dog would go racing door barking, intimidating people. So I moved my office to the church. We started opening the church. We let high school kids park in our parking lot. They had blocked off the parking lot, and the kids were crossing the street. Ford had gotten killed 20 years earlier.
Wow.
Like, this is not what a church is here for.
Right.
So we started doing ministry locally, involved with the food pantry, doing things in New York City. We started doing mission, and we actually let a Bosnian family move in. This is during the 90s after that war. There was some controversy around that. But we began being in the newspaper as a church that was helping people, and people would just come. So it was halfway through my ministry there when I went to Mozambique. And as we started building, you see, the money that we raised for Mozambique didn't hurt our church, it helped our church. Because we had plenty of access to resources. Our budget grew at the same time we were building things in Mozambique, and that allowed us to build the $1 million addition and do all kinds of ministry. So I think it was an exciting time and a time of growth.
I am not surprised by that story at all, simply because every congregation that we speak to who has become engaged in mission work, work outside of their church, opening their church doors, and perceiving the greater world as their purview, begins to see that same kind of growth. And we're hoping that more congregations will begin to see what you saw, which is that when the church starts doing the work of the church, it grows.
People come. Because when you build it, people come.
That's right.
Right.
So John Wesley said, "I see the world as my parish." That's one of his most famous phrases. What I saw happen to me was my parish became my world. So the church was growing. I was doing, I don't even know, baptisms and weddings and confirmation classes and funerals. Running a big church is a full-time job.
Yeah. Right.
And so my world shrunk in to that congregation in that town. And I was doing things on the town, you know, like your trustee library and, you know, town committees and blah, blah, blah. So what happened, the trip in Mozambique kind of enabled me to expand my horizons again. Yeah. And when I left that church, which was very painful for me in that church, when I left that church, I was able to establish a foundation for orphans. So now it's a ministry in which I try to get other churches to open up their worldview again from their parish to the world. And then I think this is the answer to a lot of the ails of the United Methodist Church. Stop fighting over sexual identity, for God's sake.
And politics and everything else.
You know,
politics.
I mean,
you know what strikes me is that when we did we transitioned an orphanage, back in 2016 in Sierra Leone, what that made us do was to stop thinking about the kids in the box. And now we're like thinking outside the walls. We're thinking outside of the outside of the walls. And what you're describing is doing that on a church level, how you think of church as not this place where we worship and have Sunday school and spaghetti dinners, which are great. I'm a fan. Don't get me wrong. But when the church starts to think of themselves outside the box, outside the walls, that helps the church to grow. I mean, I had left church. I'm a born and bred Methodist, had left the church in college, as many young people do, came back to the church, and this church, we're here at Florist United Methodist Church, which is my home church, came back to this church because they were doing a mission with kids in Africa. I'd never even thought about getting engaged in, but that appealed to me.
Exactly.
Because I don't want to be involved in conversations about sexual identity and politics at church. I want to be involved in conversations about how can the world be made better and how can I be a part of that and how can I experience the love of Christ and a relationship with God that calls me into the servant leadership. And I think that's what people are hungry for.
You're not the only one.
Yeah.
You know, that's what people are looking for in a church. People are turned over. Part of the reason where our attendance is down is because we see clergy on TV. We see the televangelists. We see the sexual scandals with priests. And, you know, it applies to United Methodists and other denominations.
Yeah.
We see all the things go wrong. We need to stand up for what can go right, you know, what we're supposed to do. People know the gospel. You know, they know that Jesus wasn't a hateful, angry, screaming, racist, you know, all these things.
Yeah.
So they're drawn to when we do the right thing.
Yeah, I think that's true.
The light on the hill.
Absolutely.
That's right.
And I think that one of the things that kind of highlights all of that is when you talk about the work that draws young people in. And frankly, the reason we do podcasts is because we're trying to reach all of you out there who have kind of tuned out to some of the standard rhetoric that comes out of mission work, out of church work, and are looking for something that's truer, more authentic, and frankly, you all listen to podcasts. So we are podcasting to reach you. And the reason that we're doing that is because we know your heart is where our heart is, which is in doing the real work.
Right.
And so we see young people who get engaged in this work are people who have seen the real work, and they can jump over this. Like, you know, people we know who are starting to engage in youth ministries.
Right.
So.
Yeah. So we know that care reform has been happening now for, well, since the UNCRC was first done 30 years ago, to change from that orphanage model to family care models. And Ellie Oswald, who's the executive director at Faith to Action, one of our good friends, often talks about how that movement, that transition from the orphanage model to family care models, that train has left the building. That's the metaphor she likes to use, is the train has left the building. And sometimes we talk about that train as feeling a little bit like a bullet train. Mm. And that, you know, if you're in this work, you have to sort of grab hold and hold on tight, because it is moving really fast. And that's not something our churches really know yet, but I think is coming. We know for centuries, Christians have stepped up to take care of orphans because it's a biblical calling, and Christians understand it as a biblical calling. And so for centuries, Christians have done that work when nobody else would. And so we've got this huge tradition of that being in our DNA, as you say. And what Ellie talks about is, you know, what would be great is if the church, and she's talking about sort of the church writ large, but I think we've been talking about it, you know, maybe even the Methodist could be this, but what if the church became the headlight on the front of this train? What if it became the lead of this, as it always kind of has been? So, you know, we're not changing what we're saying about the importance of caring for orphans. We're just changing the how, right? So we've been talking in a small group of us, and this campaign probably will have launched by the time this podcast airs. But we've been talking with a small planning group within the United Methodist denomination about an effort that we're about to launch. Wayne, do you want to just tease that out a little bit? We don't want to give too much away, but tease it a little bit.
So I'll look more back than forward, or so to lead this. But I've been aware for some time that a small percentage of United Methodist churches were actively involved in caring for orphans and vulnerable children. I've been aware for some time that we fight over sexual identity and about to split. So I was living in 2016 in Virginia Beach, and although I'm from Connecticut, I lived most of my life in Connecticut. I was in Virginia Beach after I finished my doctorate and was working down there. I conceived this idea, because General Conference was going to be in Portland, Oregon. I conceived this crazy idea of walking and running across the United States to bring a petition to General Conference that the church embrace orphans and vulnerable children as our missional focus. And long story short, I'm a lifelong runner, and I've run 9 marathons. I'm hoping to do a 10th one day. Wow. But I decided, we bought an RV, and I had a driver, my son, and I would try to run 8 to 15 miles every morning, and he'd meet me with Gatorade. Then I'd have lunch and would walk 8 to 10 miles in the afternoon. And I spoke at about 80 United Methodist Church en route. I spoke at a couple of universities, some service clubs. And I brought this petition, I want the United Methodist Church to have a unifying focus, just like individual churches. I want us to have a focus on orphans and vulnerable children, because it's biblical and it's Wesleyan. And I got to General Conference, and I saw a denomination, can I say this, hell-bent on schism. Everybody just focuses on schism. Yeah. You could see the floor like Moses parting the Red Sea between those who were traditional opinion and the progressive opinion. And every morning the bishops would say, well, let's treat each other civilly today in Christian love. And then the very first speaker would stand up and say, you guys are going to hell, or you are racist. You know, it's just like, so that didn't last very long.
Right.
And my petition was put on the back burner. It was tabled. And I've spoken to numerous bishops and numerous executive directors, and just feel like I'm this voice in the wilderness. Nobody cares. We'd rather figure out where our pension money is going to go and who's going to get the colleges and how the split's going to happen. But finally, because of you being at that meeting, you're a member of Flores, and your pastor is Tom Berlin, who's one of the denominational leaders, involved in a schism. I'm not saying the schism is not going to happen,
right.
But he's got a name. He's written books. People know him. And he's friends with Adam Hamilton, who's another name, written books, one of our big names. And I've met Michael Slaughter multiple times. Mm-hmm. So Adam and Michael and Tom have gotten on this team with us,
yeah,
and with a few other big names. And we're going to launch something at Church of the Resurrection at the end of September, where we combined are going to try to change the tithe dynamic at this church and at least get that number up from 1% to 3% to a higher percent, but maybe approach the 2024 General Conference, mm-hmm, and bring this petition that's still out there,
yeah,
forward.
Yeah.
Is that enough of a tease?
Yeah, I think that's a good tease.
That's great. Yeah, so we're hoping for a groundswell.
Yeah.
Groundswell.
When people understand that if you change your missional focus to mission,
right,
that your church will grow.
Yeah.
And people will come.
Yeah. And I think what we're doing, you know, this, we've sounded maybe a little Methodist heavy and like this is a Methodist centric thing. And I think it's coming out of that just happens to be who we are. And so that's the world in which we work and live. And that's where our push is going to come. But we also believe in radical collaboration. And so, and we often say this proverb that if you want to go fast, you go alone. If you want to go far, you go together. And I think connecting with one another, connecting Church of the Resurrection and Floris and the other partnership churches connected with Helping Children Worldwide, connecting into the child welfare organizations that have been, you know, sort of the train of this movement, I'm hoping for a groundswell and eventually a tipping point. Where people begin to believe our campaign slogan, which I'm going to reveal, I'm going to tease that out, is a strong family for every child. And I think we might see that in our lifetime, where Christians will just understand that that's God's will.
Well, if we want to be radical, so I've now spoken in my first Catholic church.
Yeah.
So the low-lying fruit for me as United Methodist pastor has been the United Methodist Church.
Yeah.
I spoke in a Catholic church. Yay, I broke that ceiling. I've spoken at congregational churches, a Baptist church. I'm trying to branch out, but I've also been able to speak at mosques. So here's the thing. I lived in Iraq after getting my PhD from 2011 to 2013, teaching at a university there in the Kurdish region, which was the safe part of the country. The Quran tells its followers 22 times to care for.
Right.
And that's in part because the Prophet himself, Muhammad, blessings be on his name, was an orphan. So his dad died before he was born. His mother died when he was 6, so he was a double orphan at age 6. He was raised for a time by his grandfather, who then died when he was 8, and then he was raised by his uncle. His uncle always saw him as the child who he didn't love.
Right.
So the Quran has all these references to caring for orphans. So in Iraq, I was able to establish a chapter, the Foundation for Orphans, and we did orphan work there. There's enough Muslims and Christians on this planet to end the orphan pandemic.
There's that phrase. What's the orphan pandemic, Wayne?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
So I used to call it the orphan crisis. I used the word pandemic because we've just come through the pandemic. By the way, is the pandemic over yet?
No, I'm afraid not.
I've got my mask.
Maskless.
I've got my mask right over there. Oh, no, it's in my pocket. I think it's in my pocket. Anyway, we all know what the pandemic is, the COVID pandemic.
Yeah.
1 million Americans have died. Well, 16,500 children die every day around the world from preventable diseases. They die in villages and cities.
Can you give me that number again?
16,500 a day.
A day.
16,500, that's 6 million a year. So 6 million a year is 6 million too many. Most of those kids are orphans. Mm-hmm. So I call it an orphan pandemic. It's a global neglect of these kids. It's a turning our back on them. I can't solve this crisis, so I'll renovate my kitchen, or I'll paint my garage, or, you know, we put so much resources into these issues that if we could all focus a little bit on the pandemic, we could end it. I can't end the orphan pandemic myself, neither can you guys.
Right.
But I'm called by God to do what I can. And if I can do what I can, I should do what I can. And if I can inspire other people to do what they can, then we can end the orphan pandemic. That's why I use the word pandemic. Since the pandemic started and since we're so keenly aware of it, then there's an orphan pandemic or crisis.
We like to flip the binoculars over and look through the other lens and refer to the pandemic, the orphan pandemic, as a family separation crisis.
Yeah.
That what is really driving this situation of repetitive child poverty and family poverty is the fact that these families have become separated from one another. Yeah. A child is separated from its family because of the death of one parent or the death of two parents.
Or they can't feed them. Or
there is so much right. poverty, which is the number one reason that children are separated from their families is poverty, that they relinquish them into a system that doesn't care for them, and then the cycle starts again.
Yeah. So Ellie Oswald, again from Faith to Action, said something to me a couple years ago that just has stuck with me. And she said, okay, if we all embrace the idea that the problem is orphanhood, the answer to that, the solution to orphanhood is not an orphanage. It's actually a family. And when she said it, it was like, you know, the penny dropped. I kind of went, duh. You know? But it's, we don't think that way. And so I think this shift, this pivot that that you embraced this spring, we're going to be going back to Helping Children Worldwide offices and be talking about how, you know, logistically you're going to engage in this transition with Foundation for Orphans. As you think about that transition with your organization, what are you excited about and what are you maybe a little more apprehensive about?
Well, so I've spoken about this transition and we've spoken about the Zoe yeah. model with Gaston Warner, Zoe Empowers. One of the things that your project, Zoe, mm-hmm. all together does is scale up.
Mm-hmm.
So for the amount of children we can have in our orphanage right now, we can have 3,000 kids. We
right.
can help 3,000.
Right.
We can get kids back into families. We can make a stronger society. Those are the selling points.
Yeah.
We're struggling with, I've had a couple of focus groups. Mm. Had a couple of focus groups talking about these things, and they're always like, well, what are you going to do with the three-year-olds that don't have family? You know, we don't think you should close the orphanages because you've got 1 and 2 and 3 year olds. And I say, well, I'm going to learn from you guys.
Right.
We're going to learn how to reintegrate them. You know, the United Nations says no more orphanages. The Mozambique government says we want to shut down the orphanages. The Bishop of the United Methodist Church wants to close down orphanages.
The train has left the station.
So when I tell them we're going to close down the orphanages, they say, well, why? Well, because the train's left the station.
Yeah. Yeah.
How? I hope.
How is the question?
I hope you're going to help me.
Yeah.
Now, one of the issues we're going to deal with is we have 4 intellectually disabled people living in our home for children in Cambini. They're all in their late 30s, early 40s.
Mm-hmm.
We have people giving us money to support the orphans, and these men are living there.
Right.
So what are we going to do with them?
Right.
So the government in Mozambique doesn't have the social services.
Right.
Doesn't have an institution for them to live in. So these are the type of things we're going to deal with. I say we'll deal with it as it comes up.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll have to have a remnant. Maybe we'll have a transition center where these 4 men live.
Right.
Indefinitely. And we transition other kids.
Yeah.
I can't be worried about the future, the things that can go wrong. What I want to do is think about the things that can go right.
Right.
You know.
So that's a great segue to our last question. So we talked about some hard things. We talk about hard things and optimistic voices. But we like to end on this, niche is what makes you the most hopeful or optimistic about your work?
Yeah, I saw that question before, and I thought I had a better answer on the way down here. I think as Christians, we have to be optimistic. We have no option. I, like everybody else, I have moments of despair and sadness, right? And I think the world is going down the wrong path. But what gives me optimism is that this is not only a chance to end the family crisis, but it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity for the church. When I'm with my college students, they've got so much energy and mm-hmm. so much enthusiasm yeah. and so much hope for the future. I think that keeps me hopeful, keeps me young at heart. It keeps me trying to work with them to build a better future. I think as Christians, we have no other option. I've always been called the eternal optimist. I see the glass not as half full, it's overflowing. And I think there's potential. So probably that's the best I can do right now.
I thought that was great. you had a better answer in the car. I need to hear it later. So anyway, I just want to say thank you for joining us on this episode of Optimistic Voices. As you know, we're big believers in radical collaboration, and that takes radical courage. We also believe that together, that radical courage, that radical collaboration, we can change the world. So I hope you join us next time on our next episode of Optimistic Voices. And hey, let's change the world together. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest from us, you can find us at Helping Children Worldwide on Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. #OptimisticVoicesPodcast.